Tonight starts a new series on the ways of the heart, and tonight's talk is on the heart's forgiveness. But I want to bracket it that with just what I'm feeling in terms of an evolutionary cycle, that I'm hoping that the human species is going through at this time, because I feel that the change is in the air, right? And I use those terms not because they were elaborated on by political figures, but because I really believe the change is in the air, and I believe that this recent election is a indication of that, but not what I'm specifically meaning. I think it's one indication that there's something, there's an evolution of consciousness that is happening that from time to time shows itself in terms of elections, but also in terms of 50,000 people at Quest Field meeting with the Dalai Lama and 10 million people dialoguing with Eckhart Tolle with on the Oprah Winfrey spiritual series. But just a general sense, this is there's a quiet evolution afoot. It gives me a lot of hope. Hope for me is not invested in a human being, because human beings come and go. But in the very nature of consciousness itself, to sustain itself, and the evolution of us out of a thicket, out of a briar patch that we have been embedded in for as long as our history has been recorded. And every once in a while, something happens where I really can almost tangibly feel it. And I think that that is the case this week. When you look at some of the faces of the people who offered their spirit and their sense of hope and invested so much hope in this U.S. election, you can really feel internationally that people are rising up with every intention to rise up, to rise themselves up, to stand up now and to move in a different way. Now, it's interesting because that is, in fact, what Buddhism has meant to do for the 2,500 years of its history. It's meant to be a vanguard, to lead the way in that evolution. But in some cases, I'm not sure it does that. I'm not sure it doesn't fight that change with its own set of staid and repetitious principles and conditioning. Because religions, once they get invested in a certain way, religions can be the very antithesis of change, can't they? And we have to be very careful that as we take on the Buddhist practices, we don't take on that reservation and resistance to the very way that it is supposed to be moving us. Hopefully, where the people in this room are willing to move is in a contemporary expression of what it means to evolve out of this particular fixed conscious ways that we have been living. And doing the pragmatic, using pragmatic resources and multiple teachings in order to do that. Not to stay necessarily within one single tradition, just hunkered down, believing and looking at every literal word that was written 2,500 years ago down in some text, and using practices that just make it seem as if something is happening, but in which when I look at my life decades from now, very little will have changed. So it's a warning sign. And because what do I mean, this evolution of consciousness, what's changing? Well, everything. I don't just mean the literal sense that everything changes, that it does, that it's a fact, but I mean the way we perceive life, the way we perceive each other, the very sense of how we feel about what life is, how we perceive it, what we know and understand it to be. That's what's changing. And in order for that change to occur, we have to move from the entrapment that we have been under, the enslaved way that we have been under the thinking mechanism of thought and how we have conceptualized life. We've been enslaved, imprisoned within that particular perceptual way we have organized life into a different organ. Now, I use the word heart not because literally the heart is that organ, but because the words that we associate with the heart, like love, compassion, sensitivity, understanding, and on, are words that we talk about when we talk about love in the heart. But let's be careful that we understand what we are really pointing to when we use the definition, when we say heart as the definition. The mind, as I am speaking about it in this series and beyond, is thought, habit, conditioning, the reference of conditioned ways that we think about things, the conceptual understanding that we place upon things, and the continual reference that we give our life in terms of the abstract way we think about it, holds the emotional narrative of our life, etc. And then the heart is the awareness, that which holds all of that, which surrounds it, which floods it, really. But when we're so invested in the particular description and abstraction that we are currently involved in, usually the narrative of our life, we don't see that there's anything that surrounds it. We don't see the ocean that surrounds the island of ourself. And so islands, because they don't see themselves connected through the ocean, see them as individual, 3-6 billion individual islands out in this great expanse. But once we begin to divest less into our thinking as the truth of life, once we are willing to question whether thoughts are accurate displays of reality, there's a very important point there, because it just doesn't come because we want it to change. It comes because we see that what we have invested in, how we have depicted reality, simply isn't true and accurate. That's how evolution occurs. We can have a lot of enthusiasm for change, but unless we do the work necessary to see what reality really looks like, free of our abstracted thought, then we have no a reality to base that change upon. And it's just wishful thinking. So that's why the accompaniment of the practice into this evolution, for most people, not for all, but for most people, is essential. Because what the practice does, in its essence, is to show us the difference between a conceptual life, starting with the breath. Every one of us knows that we breathe, but when we actually pay attention to what the breath is in as an experience, it's very different than the mechanic way that we have believed our breath, we believed our breath to be, just as a physical sensation and etc. When we actually live the experience of our breath, it's very different than the thought about it, in other words. And as we move that understanding and practice out beyond the breath, which I hope we're all doing, we begin to see our body and our minds are not what we thought they were. And lo and behold, the laws that are fundamental to the way that we have taken reality are very different than the laws that we have interpreted from abstract interpretation that have governed reality. Those laws are very different as well. And so we just keep moving this quiet attention out through ourselves and beyond, and lo and behold, we begin to perceive from a very different way than the way that we have been led to believe that life was. And it is radical, to say the least. But it's very gentle. And the evolution is very gentle. And in the 60s, it was dramatic. It was a lot of hyperbole and exaggeration and drama and color and display. But as it's matured, as it seeps into the cells of our being, and not just becomes the activity of what we want in the pronouncement, our philosophy, which was much of the 60s, a philosophy of change, philosophy of togetherness, as it actually touches the cells of our body, the cells, because this is a cellular change, then the drama is out. There's no more drama that's necessary. And we feel ourselves altered irreversibly. And it's quiet. Doesn't throw us necessarily into trauma. And the Buddha said, used the analogy of a woodcutter that has been cutting wood for 50 years. Goes out one morning after 50 years of that particular service. He looks down at his axe handle and he sees it's been worn away. But he can't say, oh, I wore so much away yesterday and so much away last week. He just notices over time that a lot has been worn away. And so too, if you stay within this, dedicated to the principle of change, not to the principle of getting yourself right and order, and in proper improved way, not in terms of self-modification, not in terms of improving yourself, but in terms of changing in accordance with the way that you see and understand life from the perspective of directly meeting life and just releasing everything that doesn't meet life directly. Because everything that doesn't meet life directly is a ponderance or a reflection on life. And that ponderance is the very basis for the last million years of evolutionary history, of subjective experience, and of commentary, inward commentary, and inward reflection, and all of the different ways that we step out of life in order to ponder what life is, rather than to abide within life as life in itself. In itself. Life in itself. Not our intelligence seeing life, but life's intelligence. He said, well, I can't trust that. Well, that's why you don't do it. Because we don't trust it. We don't have faith that this life, which is, by the way, moving, is, we don't do much to make spring occur, or the year move into fall and winter. It's moving on its own, hasn't needed us. In fact, if anything, it would love to discard us because we haven't been very beneficial to the land, to other species, or to our own species. But we think that we know better than how life is moving, and we try to move it differently. And at some point, we concede the point that we don't because we foul everything up. And when you walk into a fine china shop, and everywhere you turn, you knock over something. You think, maybe I better leave. Maybe this. My bill is getting too. So, the way we leave, and literally, is to. We rediscover ourselves. We have a certain idea of what we are, and who we have been, and who our history says we are, and who our inward narrative claims we are. But it's that we need to check out. because that's just the mental overview, our mental understanding from the reflective way that we have been perceiving ourselves in life. And so we have taken ourselves to be something we are not. And the evolution is not to change into something else, it's simply to become what we already have, what we already are. Not to try to change ourselves into some artificial form. No. This is simply to release the artificial form we've assumed. It's like taking off your Halloween mask. Halloween's over. Okay? It's been a dark day. Halloween's lasted for a long time. So let us see what light shines forth when we aren't monsters to each other. I'm switching metaphors quite a bit here. I apologize. More to come. Let's look at this thing. I try to give you lots of different ways to approach this evolution, because for some people it's scary to look at the sense of emptiness in relationship to ourself, and we say, God, that doesn't sound like a viable way for me to go. You have an alternative to that, Rodney? And I said, well, okay, how about this? How about the way of the heart? How about going towards what is deeply meaningful for you? How about going towards love, compassion, kindness, sensitivity, understanding? Can you melt with that one? You see? I can. Now, the problem is that you have to melt with that one, so you don't get out of emptiness by going through the door of love, because you see that in order to love, you have to be empty. And so, at some point, we're willing to empty ourselves out for the sake of love. For the sake of love. And we do it for the sake of love, because we see that love needs our release in order for it to work. And we see that freedom is a total embrace of life. And where we are not loving is where we are turning our back, where we are not embracing. It's, if I could stretch my arms out so that they would come together in the back, so that we'd be 360 response, that is what I would do. Because that's what I mean with a total embrace. The inclusivity, the inclusiveness of love. It's never exclusive. You see, there are absolutes. There are never absolutes unless you're talking about the absolute. And then the absolute is always absolute. Right? But I always hated absolutes because it left out the contradiction. But when you're talking about the absolute truth, then there is no contradiction because it includes everything. It is always inclusive. Now, let us look at our life in terms of that simple phrase. It is always inclusive. And immediately you can see where we are minding, M-I-N-D, a word I'm making up, M-I-N-D-I-N-G, minding. I don't know if I'm making that up or not. Maybe it is a word. Minding our life, where we are moving with it in terms of a hesitation, in terms of a conceptual judgment or philosophy of this I approve of and that I don't. And the Buddhist truth, the truth, is wide open. Wide open. Now, it so happens, I love this, that when we are wide open, hands meeting 360 all the way around, that's the living presence So another way we can frame the heart is a living presence. Living presence. Because a living presence lives presence. It puts nothing between itself as life itself. And when we live presence, we are actively engaged in life as life. Now, most of us, we're more interested in sort of having our stake in life and living it kind of as a rub. So it's rubbing against us somehow, kind of externally. But we want to keep our life separate from the life and have that external boundary called the skin. So that life is out there safely and we're in here safely and now we can have a relationship to life. And that's the evolution that we're walking out of. That's what we're evolving out of, is that skin definition of me and everything else external to that. Okay. Now, when we say it's a full embrace of life, we have to look and see where it is that we're not embracing life at all. And one of those places is our past. And this is where the talk tonight on the heart's forgiveness, I want to spend some time talking about forgiveness. Because in essence, forgiveness is one of the most damaging affixed responses to life that could ever occur spiritually. It freezes us spiritually. And we think, well, we'll just go on. We just won't pay attention to all those places in our life that I've been so unforgiving to, or been so unforgiving to me, all the places that I still feel betrayed or have betrayed others. And I will work it, I will try to work it both ways, but it's hard to, because there are different sets of laws that govern me, my self-forgiveness, and for trying to forgive others for things they did to me, but we'll deal with that as we can. And so, but let's just look at, you know, where we have forsaken what we our integrity, where we have done something that has hurt another person. And our heart feels it. It feels, in fact, you can look upon the landscape of our past. We can look upon the landscape of our past, and you can see stakes out there that have defined you at different times for what we have done that have left its trail of tears for others or for ourselves. And we can't go pull those stakes up because the event is over. The event, it's done. It's irreconcilable, isn't it? I mean, you can go to the person and say you're sorry, and I certainly suggest that is one activity towards alleviating the unforgiven, but basically it's over. And yet the trauma of it is carried psychically in us. And when we settle, you see, the mind wants us to continue in the evolution that has continued since time immemorial, and so it brings to life those areas in which we are deeply shameful, guilt-ridden. It says, how can you even think about going into your heart, being loving, when you have done this 2 years ago, and 5 years ago you did that, and 10 years ago you did this, and yesterday you cut that man off in the middle of I-5. Okay? And let me define guilt and shame. Guilt is what we feel about something we do in terms of an event. An event happens and we don't live up to our expectation or ideal, and so we feel guilty about our response. Shame is a quality of character where we believe ourselves to be a certain way. And if we have enough incidences of guilt in us, we will become shameful. We will feel our attitude towards life and towards ourselves will be one that will be guilt-ridden or shameful. And a shameful personality, a shameful character, and many of us have gone through that from time to time, is always looking uphill. And it's always ready to apologize for something it hasn't even done, but because it feels like it's, by its very existence, that it carries a kind of guilt along with it as it moves, that it feels the need to apologize in life. And so we're always looking uphill. It's a constant battle just to stay and take the next breath because of the way we hold ourselves with so much contempt and project it out. We think everyone sees us in that way. And we try to continually compensate for that with behavior that is very out of balance. And you can feel it in people when they're overly apologetic or overly subservient or just meek to the point of not holding their own place on earth, you know. And you can we get a sense that what must be behind that is enormous amount of betrayal and guilt, and perhaps festered and encouraged by a strong sense of unworthiness. So these are all, each one of us have a character that we bring to the present. Each one of us have a character. There's no way around it. Circumstances, our life, the years of our history, a certain character has been molded over time, and that's what we bring to the present. Now, whether we continue to invest and encourage that momentum so that our present history then has a way to continue into the future, being reinforced into the future in the same way, or whether we can arrest this thing, stop it. It's a little bit like trying to put on, you know, a quick stop to a freight train because of the weight that our momentum is carrying. It takes a long time to stop a freight train. In the same way, the cars, the loaded cars of this freight train, give us psychic drag when we are trying to stop. Because meditation, we really are trying to stop this thing. So enough of this. What am I doing to myself in this moment? How does each moment encourage the next reconfiguration of me in the next moment? How does my past compel me towards the next unforgiving moment? I'm never quite up to the task. And so by necessity, I need a future because I can't let that guilt-ridden past define me in the present, so I need a future to work this out. So when we have that sort of almost tragic background, then the only survival and the only thing that can save us is not the present moment, because the present moment just communicates the tragedy we're in, the helpless and hopeless character we are. So it must be the future. I have to have a future, you see? And so this gets the train not stopping, but moving faster from the past through the present to that future where salvation might occur. And this is at the heart of the population suffering and conflict. Because we're really not, so interested in the relationship of the present. We're not so interested in meeting what is here. Here it doesn't represent anything of delight. We have to get out of here to get to there. And so our foot is on the throttle, not on the brake. And yet the meditation is encouraging us to brake, to use the other pedal on this thing. And so it's the question is, first of all, are we using the meditation in alignment with what we are encouraged to do here? To stop. To look at this. To look at the narrative, which sustains, you see, our narrative sustains yesterday. Because all of the unforgiveness is only sustained through our narrative. And so we begin to look at the narrative, what we tell ourselves about ourselves. Yes, but you don't understand, Ray, I really did do this. And the lack of forgiveness, the retention of the past, unable to let go because of the emotional impact of that event. This should not have happened to me. I should not have done this to someone. But there's no reconciliation. It's over. If we could send you back in time, great. Go work it out. But you can't. We can't. And yet we carry the monster that we think we are only within the narrative of our being. What we need, it's like, you know, when you go to an internet site that doesn't quite, it's kind of not quite coming together, you push the refresh button. We need a refresh button. And this extreme personalization of an issue, extreme personalization of a situation. I worked for a little while in a nursing home as a social worker. And I was just going in and out of different rooms. This was many, many years ago. And I noticed in one of the rooms an elderly woman with a vegetative person in bed, and she would sit there day after day. And one time I just stopped in. I introduced myself. She introduced herself. And I just asked her, who she was in relationship to the person in the bed. She said she was her mother. And I said, what happened? And she said, well, this woman was probably about 40. The woman in the bed, her daughter was about 40. She said when the daughter was 13, she and her mother had a terrible argument, and her daughter went into her room and hung herself. And the mother found her before she was completely dead. She cut her down. And she had been in this vegetative state now for 30 years. And she has come and stayed. She has dedicated her life to coming by her daughter's, being by her daughter's bedside every day for the last 30 years. She's lost her marriage. Her friends have all left. Just on and on in terms of the tragedy of the situation. And you could just feel that this woman was so, there was so much self-recrimination, so much guilt around that act, that it was never going to be alleviated, no matter how many years she sat by her daughter's bed. Now that is a rather dramatic tale of something that many of us do, because we keep bringing to mind certain things that we have done in which there's no retribution. There's no healing that could possibly occur. And yet somehow we begin to define ourselves, almost as a mother by the child's bed, define ourselves by those actions. Through those actions, there comes a life script that gets molded around that lack of forgiveness, in which we can't even orient ourselves to a different posture of life than this lack of forgiveness. I did it. The orientation. First, you say, how do I forgive myself? Well, if forgiving yourself means that you're going to forget the event, forget it. It's not going to happen. You will not forget the event. Nor should you. So the first thing to do is to open to the event. I did it. I said it. I did it. Believe me. There are many things, many tales I could tell you of places where I have gone where I wish I hadn't. I did it. It just occurred to me one day. Stop wondering, Rodney. Just look at it. Look at it square on, like a photograph or a movie in front of you. And just orient yourself to the fact that, don't try to rationalize why you did it and the circumstances, and just see that you did it and begin there. Now, is forgiveness possible? It's as possible as letting go of a thought. That's how possible forgiveness is. But if the thought holds us, if we've integrated so thoroughly our character within that thought, then you can see how difficult it's going to be to let that thought go. But I'll tell you, if any of you have ever seen somebody die or go through death, they often come to a place in which they want to go through life review, in which they want to tell their story. They want to get out those areas, those stakes in the ground. They want to talk about them. They want to try to pull them up. They want to do something. And because they see they don't have any more time to delay, procrastinate, turn away, pretend that it didn't happen, which many of us do, thinking that they will just go away in memory. They don't go away in memory, I can tell you, by having been with the dying. We have to pull them up. So what is forgiveness? It's not pardoning the wrong. It's facing the total impact of the wrong. Feeling the pain it caused. I'll tell you a personal one, just to show you that I have as many as you have. I was a young school social worker in Cincinnati, Ohio, many, many, many years ago. And it was Christmas break, and the school system I was with gets off around mid-December. And a young 12-year-old boy came over to me and said that he was very depressed and needed someone to talk to. And I was just organizing my papers in my desk so that I could leave for Christmas, which was starting that afternoon, and this was maybe 3 o'clock in the afternoon and maybe a 4 o'clock or 5 o'clock end of the day. And I saw that this was going to be a long, involved relationship, so I said, look, why don't you come back as soon as Christmas break is over and we'll meet. And he begrudgingly said yes and left the room. Over Christmas, he killed himself, 12 years old. So I come back to that fact. What do you think that feels like inside, you see? How do you live with that? What do you do? So not kind of a way. You see, you can't pretend. Well, if you say, oh, it was Christmas Eve and I was in a hurry. No, you see, I didn't have time. Okay, so you don't make it more than what it was, but you take on what it was. I didn't have time. I just didn't want to do it, basically. I didn't want to stay beyond the hour. I knew it would be prolonged. So there it is. So you're totally accepting one's role within it without any sense of deflected blame or self-pity or elaboration. Of course I didn't know what he was going to do, and of course I would have stayed had I known, right? So that's not even, we don't have to go through all that. That's given. And there you sit. You sit there, you see, you feel the full embrace of your being in that moment and its limitation, which all of us do moment after moment, don't we? We meet our parents. We really have very, very good intentions when we meet our parents, so open to their character, which we never have in 50 years, but we're going to this time. We sit down over Christmas, you know, and it's like we fall right back into it. And we don't know what happened. We come out of the house and we like don't know what happened. Every one of us have those limitations of orientation. Our conditioning just is too strong, right? And what we need and what is given and what is the moment as it's arising is not ideal for us. And in those emotional residues and in that incomplete response, things are misinterpreted and the unforgiving. So I'm willing to see that. I wasn't up to the task. I wasn't up to the task. I wasn't all benevolent. I wasn't all compassionate. I had time for this and didn't have time for that. And that was it. You don't move from that, though, you see. And then, when we don't move, something quite beautiful happens. There's space. The evolution begins. As long as we're toing and froing about how we should have been better and how we should have this and should have that and must do it the next, all that, there's no space there. But when we this is what I did. I see the whole story right there in front of my eyes, and I'm not moving from it. Space. Heart. The evolution is occurring. The evolution is occurring. Forgiveness may not be reconciliation. It takes two people to reconcile, but only one to forgive. The first step in forgiveness, and the all-important one, is to have the intention to forgive yourself. You may not feel like you're worthy of it, but if you have the intention, if you set energetically the intention that I'm not going to live with my unforgiveness, that's the all-important first step. And then, as I mentioned, to admit what happened without excuses. And the story truthfully, as I remember it. And then the third step is to feel the residual emotions, the pain after the fact of what occurred, the trouble, all of that, the residual emotion, often anger if we were self-betrayed, or grief. In this case, for me, it was grief. Just the sorrow of not having made a sufficient connection so that I knew the depth of the pain. To feel that. I can feel that. Can you feel that? You see, we can all feel that. So that then, with the understanding that the whole person is not the sum of their behaviors, that there is light here even if the darkness is shining through momentarily, that this evolution of spirit is coming back into light, not the dark consciousness of my lack of integrity and my deceit and all that's all from my contracted sense of self-worth. And but to give the spirit a chance, to give the light a chance. Okay, not by adding more deceit to the deceit, but by adding truth to the deceit. This is how I remember it. This is what happened. And to understand that this is a practice, that it is rarely finished. And so even tonight, as I was speaking that story, the pain comes back. That's okay. Perhaps for the rest of my life, but it's okay. The stake has long since been pulled. It doesn't define me. I don't think endlessly about how awful I was. You pull it up and you move on. And when the pain is there, you honor the pain. Okay, good, there it is again. I have a story, talks a little longer tonight, if you just be patient, of a woman who, many of you know this story, she had her 8-year-old son was out on the playground. He was on parallel bars. The class bully grabs her son's legs, yanks him off the parallel bars. He falls and cracks his head, runs home. Her mother into his mother's arms. Mother puts him into the car on the way to the hospital, and he dies. 2 weeks later, she hears from the teachers and classmates that this boy, the person who did this, perpetrated a crime, has just been ostracized and relegated to abuse and name calling. She gets in her car, goes over to the school, enters the classroom, and says, 2 weeks after her son's death, you will not treat this boy in this manner. There has been enough pain from this incident. You will not do that. This child will not be governed by that form of judgment. Let him live. It was a mistake. Step 5 is letting, holding that scene and letting it burn itself out and letting ourselves wail if we have to wail or whatever the emotional response to it is. But don't let the residual anger and shame make us think that we have more to do, because shame, once it picks up that smell, that scent, will say to us, oh, we have more to do. We're shameful. We have more to do. And it will forever keep us caught up in the sense of compensation, doing something to offset the feeling I'm having. Feel the feeling we're having. But don't let it take us into a shameful behavior or compensation behavior. If we have to say, I'm sorry, say I'm sorry and mean it, because we do mean it. But not overcompensation. You feel the emotion and let it rest there. No additional narrative here. And now we're moving into the heart. Out of the circumstantial reference point, the determined conceptual reference point of the mind. That's what it means to grow. Is that we end the past. We step out of the past and look around, and there is nothing but life, nothing but spirit, nothing but now. And so may it be for all of us. Can we sit for a minute or two? Thank you. So as we sit, just surround everything that arises with now. Don't ever lose our placeholder. So what that means then is that we're bringing the heart into everything that arises. And when we do that with intention, listen to that, when we do that with intention, that's the transforming quality of the evolution. That's the seed that makes the evolution occur. So if there are any questions or comments, be happy to. Yes, sir. Yes, sir. Whoever said that, please. Yes. Yeah, that's the thing. That's the overcompensation. I understand that. That's most people. He says that he has a hard time letting go of forgiveness because he says only through that lack of forgiveness can he pay back. He says it's the wrong. And that's the mind's interpretation of forgiveness, is to use its self-abuse to equal the scale, to balance the scale. It's like. It's equivalent to having to worry about somebody to show that you really love them. And if you stop worrying about them, then do you really love them? If you step out of your lack of forgiveness, does it really mean that you have forgiven, or does it mean that you don't care? You see, that's basically what we're afraid of. And as long as we are in pain, it shows that we must have cared at some point, because look at all the pain I'm in. Okay, so we have to be wiser than this. The mind will entrap us into that kind of conceptual deceit. What's important, and what I often see, is that when I hold the scene, when I'm allowed myself to really feel the scene completely, and I allow my heart to come in, I know that there is growth occurring, so that if a similar situation happened, there would be a different response. And that self-recrimination keeps that growth from happening. It keeps me feeling so low in myself that I can't actually learn anything from the moment at hand. All I want to do is to tell you how sorry I am. But that's not growth. Love is growth. And so if I find myself doing that, I'm catching, go, wait a second here. Let me just hold this. Let me just see what occurred. See where I was limited in that moment, exactly the details of this as I can remember them. And then I just have tremendous faith that whatever needed to be learned is learned, and now I can let it go. And that if I want to stay present in love, I cannot carry my sense of personal, my personal story and my tragedy of story with me. That will keep me from love, and that it's only in love that I can really truly change. So the less I self-betray that love by holding a narrative within the moment, the more I'm available to love without that narrative. Now you have to find your way into that, but I've just told you the absolute truth. But if you want to be someone who just can't, whose character is now formed around those tragedies and will forever be shamefully moving uphill to try to recover some sense of sanity in oneself, the journey is never going to end in that. Never going to end. And so it's like a cold slap in the face here. Wait a second here. That's it. It's not going to work that way. It doesn't work that way. I step out of this, or I'm a forever in it. And so I do it with dignity. Nothing I said tonight was a whitewash or a rationalization. It was a complete confrontation, a complete embodiment of what occurred. And I stepped through that embodiment out into love. Not an aversion to it or in any kind of reinterpretation of events. No, it's exactly what this is it. As best as I can remember. Okay, all. Thank you. Did you have something at the back there? Yes.
But then the other alternative, I always felt like there were two alternatives. One was to punish myself, and the other was to say, I will never do that again.
Yeah, you did both of those are punishment.
Both of them. I didn't realize that because one of them puts me in the past and one puts me in the future.
Yeah, exactly.
Neither of them puts me in
love. Maybe one of them puts you in love. That's a beautiful insight, dear. I hope that stays with you. She said she realized that she could self-punish herself, or she could say, "I'll never do this again." And that rigidity of view. First of all, the rigidity of view assures you that the shadow will be there, in the aversive state that one is in when it says, "I will never do this again." It assures you that you will do it again. Because you're not taking into account the human quality. And anytime you turn your back on any statement of yourself, that statement is going to step forward. And so when we embrace what is there, in both sides of the issue, I wish I hadn't done it, that's true. I did do it, that's also true. God knows if I'll ever do it again, but I hope to learn from it. There we are. That covers all the squares. Then we can move forward.